This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
I don't know about you, but I'm often stuck on Bob Dylan's words. Something is happening here, but you don't know what it is. Wouldn't it be great if we could take a course to understand reality as it really is? The course exists. Dr. Nathan J. Hagans teaches Reality 101, a survey of the human predicament, to students at the University of Minnesota. Nate Hagans is a familiar name to anyone who tracks energy and resilience. Nate was a successful Wall Street trader. He left all that in 2003 to probe deeper. Nate is on the board of directors of the Post Carbon Institute and a director of the Bottleneck Foundation, and he teaches. He's working on a book that he doesn't want to talk about yet. Hagans lives on a farm in Wisconsin with a collection of animals. Nate, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, we have guests that see everything in terms of energy, and others focus just on the environment. I've also had eco-psychologists. You're one of the few who are trying to wrap these all up together. Why is that?
Well, I think unless you know the whole picture or a large part of the whole picture, you end up coming to erroneous strategies and conclusions. And so some of the things you mentioned are actually the three core pillars that I taught my students and that I think are important to know. One is that we are causing the sixth great extinction. It's not just climate change and ocean acidification. I mean, those impacts are even on the horizon. It's squeezing out of nature, which we can get into more details. The second is that energy underpins everything in our civilization, and our hopes and expectations are based on fossil slaves, which are no longer going to be available in the number and strength that they have over the last century. And that means an end to the growth trajectory. And then the third thing is when we talk about the human problem of climate change and energy depletion and pollution and poverty and all these things, we really don't have those problems. We really have a human problem. So we have to look at the fact that we carry with us baggage from our evolutionary past and what the human animal is really about. So I teach my students probably half the semesters on human behavior.
Well, we'll get to those big picture demands that you make of your students, but I was struck by a course requirement to spend at least an hour a week outside, away from phones, computers, connectivity. Why is nature part of an academic study?
Well, these are mostly freshmen and some sophomores in my class, and they're honor students, and they read a whole lot. Just in my class, they read about 10 hours a week of readings, and it seems to me that kids nowadays are brought up with kind of low attention span gadgets, and when I was that age or younger, I every day after school, I spent 2 or 3 hours in the foothills in southern Oregon with my dog looking at salamanders and trees and blackberries and deer and such. And I think kids nowadays, a lot of them haven't had that experience. So when we're talking about the bottlenecks of the 21st century and the human clash with everything that's coming, I think we have to engage both the head and the heart. So I assigned them 1 hour of being in nature with no technology and no talking, just kind of sitting and thinking about the things we learn in class, sitting in a wild setting, and I think that's important.
And you offer them another tool that helps them deal with the uncomfortable aspects of what we're about to talk about, and I thought, well, maybe that'll help our listeners too. What is that?
Well, the first day of class, I handed out a nice little journal, a diary, to all the students, and I told them not to share that with me. It was for their own kind of emotional reactions to the things that we learned in class. They should have another notebook for the class notes and studying for quizzes and things, but this was just for their own thoughts when they learn about how important fossil fuels have been to our population increase and our consumption levels, when they learn about what's happening to the oceans and, 40% of terrestrial vertebrates are gone since they were born type of things. Those are very depressing and emotive facts, and I wanted to just give them somewhat of an outlet to express themselves and maybe come back later in their lives and look at what they were thinking when they were 19.
Well, right. Nate Higgins, you are well known as an energy commentator. What does the current glut of oil and these low prices tell us about peak oil theory and energy limits?
Well, you used an important term there, Alex. You said energy prices. I think most people are unaware that there's a difference between price and cost. And the price today, oil was down 5% in the public market, closed under $30 a barrel. That's what consumers pay. But that's not the cost of oil. The cost of oil has gone up over 15% a year annualized the last 15 years or so. The cost to energy companies in extracting that. Now, we're having a little bit of a bout of deflation globally because of China kind of hitting the brakes on some things, and that means that the cost of oil is maybe dropping a little bit. But if you look at what price the oil companies need to break even globally, it's probably over $50 all in. And on the really expensive marginal barrel, it's upwards of $80 or $90. So when we talk about $30 is what consumers are paying, yet the oil companies are all losing money at that level, what that means is there's going to be a lot less investment in infrastructure and new drilling and things like that to replace the depleting older fields. So I think that oil is probably peaking very soon. In response to your question about peak oil, though, I don't like that term because it just focuses on when there's going to be a peak and a decline, and it doesn't tell the larger story that at really expensive oil, say oil was $400 a barrel, well, the oil companies are going to go out there and find more oil at $400 a barrel. But the benefits to society are going to be substantially less the higher oil prices go. So I prefer to call it peak benefits as opposed to peak oil, and I would argue that peak benefits is about a decade ago. In other words, the benefits that society gets from super cheap oil have already peaked and are declining, and you see it all over with lower wages, and half of Americans have less than 3 months of savings, wealth inequality. You see it in Europe with the refugee crisis, and all those things are tethered to higher costing fossil fuels.
You know, the course that you're offering has some really challenging texts and videos on systems theory and complexity, and it strikes me only a few people are really going to get this. And is there some sort of social machinery or way to make this knowledge useful to make it work? I mean, do you believe in trickle-down consciousness?
Trickle-down consciousness, what is that?
Well, let's say your students get it. Just a few of your students really get it. Get a picture of how this world is working. Will they be able to make any difference, or are there other great big pieces of machinery that just keep us going in the same direction anyway?
Well, that's numerous questions, Alex. I will tell you this first off, that you saw my syllabus. It is a lot of stuff. It's integrating anthropology, evolutionary psychology, energy, economics, debt, environment, all into one cohesive picture. There wasn't a section that my kids didn't understand. They grasped it all. Now, what was still an open question is a 19-year-old or is anyone emotionally capable of synthesizing all this and coming up with a life plan? I think the bigger question isn't can you understand the complexity. It's how do you construct a lifestyle around knowing what's happening and being at college in order to get a job, to be a consumer, and all that. But I personally think it's kind of depressing to synthesize all this, but someone's got to know it. Because if no one engages with the larger challenge of what are humans going to do this century, what do we aspire to, you know, then we're going to kind of be the lemmings that just go off the cliff in various ways. So I do think it's not entirely threatening. Some of it is exciting, but I do want more people to think in systems, and I wish that it could happen in sixth grade and eighth grade with some of this ecology and things. I mean, my kids were just totally shocked at how vital energy is to our lives. The fact that one barrel of oil has 11 years of human labor in it, and we pay now $30 for it. It's just crazy that they're 19 years old and they never had any idea about that. So those sort of things, I think we would be better to instill much earlier.
And you've got a course section on geologic time and paleoclimatology. Dr. Peter Ward, who's been a several-time guest on Radio EcoShock, is featured twice in your syllabus. Why Peter Ward?
Well, he's been on your show.
Oh, yeah, twice. Maybe three times.
He's one of my heroes. I mean, I just had a little email exchange with him a couple months ago. I've read most of his books. He's a systems thinker. He's what I like to label a proto-sapiens, or someone that can look beyond all the distractions and focus on kind of the core issues. And I just generally like his demeanor and what he studied. The reason that I assign his stuff to my students is he's one of the few people that has studied and looked at the commonality of prior mass and mini extinctions, and CO2 was a common link in almost all of them, if not all of them. There's now evidence that the meteor that hit 65 million years ago, there was already a CO2 pulse that had started a couple hundred thousand years before that. So just to kind of look at the context of deep time, when we talk about billions of years or hundreds of millions of years, it's like talking about billions or trillions of dollars. Our brains just can't grasp that. So one of the tools I like to use with young people is I bring either a stromatolite, which is a 2-billion-year-old cyanobacteria, or I like to have like a 100-million-year-old piece of amber with an insect in it that was frozen in amber. And when you're looking at that insect in amber, when that insect was alive, dinosaurs were still a conditional probability in the future. They didn't even exist yet. And when you're looking at that and holding it in your hand, it allows you to experience in your mind deep time actually happened, and I'm holding part of it now. And when you think about deep time backwards, you can also possibly think about deep time forward, and all the lives of different creatures, including humans, have not yet been on the planet, and it's kind of a profound thing to think about.
Well, we are a short blip on that time scale, but we have evolved even in our own time. I watched a Reality 101 course video about evolutionary psychology. It's a YouTube interview with John Tooby and Lita Cosmides on Stone Age minds. Do you find yourself agreeing that the human mind doesn't arrive as a blank slate but may have structures designed to cope with the problems of a hunter-gatherer society right inside us?
Well, of course I agree with that because I assigned my students that. It's I don't know about Canada, but I've given lectures in Europe, and it's like obvious to students there. But in America, it, especially with the high standard deviation of high school education, it was a real eye-opener to students to think that we, all of us alive today, are descended from the best of the best, an unbroken series of ancestors who had access to resources, were successful in mating, were successful in raising offspring, and all those adaptations that led to their success were kind of hardwired in our ancestors, and we have those things. So we know with certainty that we spent a very, very, very long time in small bands of between 50 and 150 tribal members on the plains of Africa, and we are descended from them. You can imagine what are the things that led to their success, and those are the things today that shout loudest in our brain. Things like jealousy and in-group preference and fear, you know, all the things that led to their success are still with us today, and we just are reacting in a different world. When we have a craving at night for Haagen-Dazs ice cream or nachos with cheese sauce, it's our brain reacting to these supernormal stimuli of today that weren't available in our ancestral past, but the neurotransmitters and the brain signals are telling us this is good for you. You need more of this because our ancestors had adaptive advantages. So once you start looking at human behavior with the lens of we are carrying around a Stone Age mind, and it's not all facts and what culture dictates that drives us, that we have these genetic leashes. It really kind of is a powerful lens into looking at what's possible and what's unlikely in our behaviors.
I'm Alex Smith, talking with Nate Hagans about Reality 101. Nate, you've also written an article, The Psychological Roots of Resource Overconsumption. I couldn't find that anywhere online. What is it about?
Well, it's kind of what I was just saying. It's that we are forming years as a species. We're in an environment of scarcity and privation. And now we're in an era of plenty because of fossil largesse, giving us all kinds of gadgets and ability to fly to the moon or fly to Australia and ship things to us. And so if we look at our evolved drivers, there is no natural negative feedback living in a tribal setting in Africa to more stuff. We just kind of had what we could get and carried around with us. Now there is no instinctive limit to our craving for more and more stuff. And I used to manage money for billionaires on Wall Street, and I could see that it was just the feelings that they were after every day, trying to get from $300 million to $400 million in their bank account. It didn't really count for anything. They weren't happier. They didn't, need that extra money, but they were getting the same neurotransmitters that our ancestors got on the Pleistocene when they killed a big animal and brought it back to the tribe. And I think there's also the addiction aspect to it, and we get higher and higher hedonic ratchets, higher and higher levels of baseline stimulation from modern things. I actually am worried about young people today that spend so much time on Facebook and Vines and Twitter and Instagram, and every time we do that, we get a little bit more neurally hijacked because this is like cocaine to our brain relative to the experiences our brain was formed for. And what happens is, planting a tomato or doing a nature hike on Vancouver Island doesn't shout as loudly to people as this new technology. And I fear that as today's youth gets older, they're not going to have the attention span to deal with some of the very physical problems coming down the road.
Well, speaking of physical problems, I want to skip over to another topic here. Do you think there's a hidden crisis in agriculture?
Well, the hidden crisis in agriculture is that, a third of our arable land has gone away in the last few decades via pollution and washing into the ocean. And we don't seem too concerned about that because we just put new fertilizer on it the next year, which comes from fossil fuels. 150 years ago, our bodies were entirely formed from sunlight and soil, and now 50% of the protein and 80% of the nitrogen in our bodies comes pretty much directly from natural gas via the Haber-Bosch fertilizer process. So we are kind of walking fossil fuels. And I think there's no plan for what to do after our fossil fuels kind of deplete and go away. And they're not, we're not going to run out of oil and gas and coal, but the cost of extracting it is going to get so high, and it's currently subsidized by, financial shenanigans, that we're not going to be able to afford a lot of what is projected as a physical resource in the ground. Sure, there's a lot of hydrocarbon molecules there, but can we afford them? And then, the other thing, Alex, I don't know if this is on one of your later questions, but it's not as if we have a choice to live this way for 500 or 1,000 more years, and that's what we're sacrificing. This stuff's going away in the next generation or two, no matter what we do. And so we're just so focused on the present. Quarterly earnings is, that's what everyone's talking about, but we don't even have a 5-year plan, let alone a 20-year plan or a 50-year plan or a 1,000-year plan. And that, again, is because of our evolutionary psychology. Our ancestors that focused on the distant future would have been outcompeted by people or organisms that consumed any food they found. So to defer reward is something that's kind of against our nature.
I disagree in one sense, though, because we did adapt to living in northern climates by figuring out how to store some food. So there is that idea of storing, as the Egyptians did. They stored grain for several years.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That just modulates the expected standard deviation of feast or famine. So, yeah, we can focus on the next season out, but where the Egyptians focused on 50 years out, I mean, we never really had to before. There was always, you know, some new horizon or a new continent to go to, but now we're living on an ecologically full planet, so the rules might be a little bit different.
Well, if things don't go well, and there are plenty who are pessimists now, in your course Reality 101, there is a segment on mass extinction. Where do you stand on the idea of human extinction, whether it's in this century, as suggested by Dr. Guy McPherson, or in the next coming centuries?
Well, you brought up Guy McPherson. I actually showed my students on the climate change part of the class a video, one of his videos, and I showed it back-to-back with a video from a former Greenpeace guy named Patrick Moore, who's denies that climate change is a concern and actually thinks that burning fossil fuels has staved us off from the death of plant life. And both of these guys are articulate and intelligent and trained and believable, but they come across with wildly different conclusions. And I think that exercise was intended to show them that there's a vast disparity of opinions on climate change, but it really hammered home some of what I tried to teach them about cognitive biases and the fact that we are definitely not rational creatures. And so I, you know, as far as extinction goes, I view the world as a probability distribution, and I think some bad things are definitely possible. Actually, some bad things are pretty likely. I think extinction is extremely unlikely, and I will definitely not say zero, but we're awfully adaptive creatures. The problem I have with Mr. McPherson is to say, oh, we're going extinct, there's nothing we can do, there's all these climate feedbacks. To have that position is functionally equivalent to being a denier of these problems, because neither camp will accomplish anything. It hasn't F-word happened yet, so Guy and his acolytes are being useless, in my opinion. And if they really think that these things threaten the world, they should be out there doing some inconvenient things trying to stop it. So I think the nihilistic, we're going to go extinct, is not a productive thing, even if it were true. I think we're going to go through various bottlenecks this century, and I would bet that we're going to have more people alive as opposed to less in the next 20 or 30 years. Not saying that's a good thing, I just think that's probably likely. But this all comes down to, what do we aspire to? And I think that's a question that's just not being asked enough. I mean, we're all concerned about climate change, so let's build solar panels. And, you know, we're concerned about financial depletion, so our financial currency crises, let's buy some gold. I mean, we just don't have a plan on what humans, now that we know where we came from, who we are, what we need, what we're doing to the planet, what's the plan? What do we really want to do with our time here? And I'm hoping that young people can address that question and start thinking about it, because I think the older people are kind of cognitively checked out because it seems too daunting.
You know, we're not going to have time to really get into what the climate ocean bottleneck is, but you said it really affected your students. Could you at least give us a snapshot of what you're talking about there?
Well, we had a week on climate change and a week on ocean acidification, and we showed some videos and stories about what the ocean continuing to take up the excess CO2 might imply for the future. And I don't think we know enough about any of this stuff to know with certainty what's going to happen. But, you know, I'm in Minnesota and we're not near the ocean here. And I think a lot of people just think the ocean is where we get shrimp and mahi-mahi from, and they don't really think about the complexity and the creatures there. So to think of how much the ocean has already been decimated. You know, 90% plus of pelagic fish is gone, 98% of whale biomass gone. And to put an emotional face on those things, my writing partner has experience with cetaceans, and not only in researching them, but also having them as friends. And so hearing his personal stories about relationships with dolphins, et cetera, hit the kids pretty hard, because we don't know if the food webs will exist. I'm not talking about this century, but in the next 1,000 years, if the ocean acidifies greatly, that has pretty ominous implications for some of those other mammals in the ocean.
Yes, I just interviewed a scientist who did a study on plankton and found it's possible that the source of our oxygen could be greatly depleted if the ocean warms too much, but that's a whole other topic. I do want to get to this point here. On resilience.org, I found another text required in the course. It's called A Prosperous Way Down. It's by Howard and Elizabeth Odom. Is there a prosperous way down, and why should we accept going down at all?
I don't think we're ever going to vote to keep carbon in the ground. I think our fossil slaves are going to be leaving us before we leave them. And that's going to mean one thing almost for sure: there's going to be a lot more poverty, and it's going to be deeper poverty. I think that Americans, and I think Canadians are pretty similar, we consume around 230,000 calories a day, and our bodies only need 3,500 or 3,000. So all that excess energy that we consume from coal, oil, and natural gas is around 70 times what our bodies need. So as far as a prosperous way down, there's a heck of a lot of buffer. We're living at one of the richest times, with the exception of the natural world, the richest times in the history of our species. So there's a lot of potential navigable ways down. But, you know, the agenda of the gene, as it were, the things that shout loudly to us when we feel like we've been unfairly treated and other people are getting more than we are, or other nations, you know, war and violence and those sort of things are likely companions on that. But I think it all comes down to what you were saying before about some trickle-down consciousness of who we are, what we want, and what makes us happy. And I flip back and forth between naive optimism and despair on how this all plays out. But I think to have young people engaged with reality of energy, environment, and behavior, you know, there could be some emergent properties that are actually pretty exciting. And we can't visualize it now. It's so natural for us to kind of hear some bad news in the internet or in our emails and extrapolate that forward. But I think there's quite a few possible positive game moves that are left.
Okay, so what does the individual do about this?
Well, I think you know that I'm writing a book kind of on that. I think you have to kind of take your awareness of likely futures, which we're going to have basically less stuff, or at most the same amount as today. And I think we have to look at choosing our own paths during that time, where we pick our friends and we pick our pastimes and we choose what we value. And I'm going to hopefully have a longer list of that to share with you the next time we talk. But it has to do with kind of dismissing the consensus trance of what other people value and what they think is the goal, and march to your own drummer a little bit. I don't think we're going to stop the heat engine, as it were, of burning fossil fuels, but I think we can meet it halfway, and that comes from individuals and then groups of individuals and then towns and nations, et cetera.
When do you think your new book will be ready?
Excellent question. You know, it's hard to kind of tell the whole story in a way that can be understood and grasped, but also in a inspiring and hopeful way, because I am hopeful that we're going to make some good decisions that we can't yet see. I would hope by the beginning of next semester, which would be September, it'll all be ready, and I will definitely send you a copy.
Great. Well, thank you for talking with us today. And by all means, let's talk about this book when it comes out later this year.
Thanks, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. It's not easy trying to become aware in a troubled world. Nate Higgins takes his students at the University of Minnesota through a wide but shallow collection of tools in his course called Reality 101, A Survey of the Human Predicament. Nate has a master's degree in finance from the University of Chicago and a PhD in natural resources from the University of Vermont. He left Wall Street Money to become an alternative social critic. His personal website is called The Monkey Trap, but he doesn't update that much. I'll put some link to Nate Higgins' articles and a few key YouTubes from the course in my show blog at ecoshock.info.
Radio EcoShock.